calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. A lot going on today. Fox News calling Ted Kennedy an enemy combatant or an alien. I forget the front. Well, I'll play the clip for you in a few minutes. We'll get around to that. Mitt Romney and Gordon Smith taking somewhat different positions on the war, and might this have something to do with the leader of the Mormon Church, oddly enough, and we'll get into that, and methane gas escaping from the ocean, creeping up on ships at sea, and maybe New York City, a new explanation possibly for what's going on. Could it have something to do with the fact that 2006 was the warmest year ever? But right now, Gary Sutton is with us. His website, MediaCorporateCanaries.com, which is also the topic of his book, Corporate Canaries, Avoid Business Disasters with a Coal Miner's Secret, business turnaround expert Gary Sutton. And his op-ed piece recently, the seven mostly funny Walmart objections. Gary, welcome to the program.
Tom, I'm terrified to be here.
You're right. I can tell. and we're very pleased to have you here with all your terror, Gary. You're suggesting that Walmart coming to town is just a fine thing and that communities really shouldn't worry about it at all.
I think pretty much that's it.
You say, for example, this the idea that Walmart's and if we may, actually, let's expand this, because in fact in your article, I mean, you start out by talking about Barnes and Nobles and things. Let's expand this beyond just Walmart's to talk about, you know, very large big box retailers. That the concern that small businesses are destroyed is a nonsensical concern.
I don't think it's nonsensical. I think that the small businesses that the Walmarts and the Barnes and Nobles compete with are in for a very tough time, and it's part of a natural progression that goes way back to, I don't know, the first A&P grocers and Safeways and the corner groceries disappearing. And if you look at their Christmas sales for both Walmart and Barnes and Noble, they're starting to flatten out themselves a little bit.
Well, that's a function of the insane economic policies this country's been following for 26 years. But when a local store, I don't disagree with you that this, we can track this all the way back to A&P and Kroger in the early days, largely in the 50s and 60s when this kind of thing started growing. And arguably, I mean, you know, back to the Sears catalog in the late 1900s, if you want. But here's the point. When a small local business or even a large local business is a local business, they're hiring local attorneys to do their work. They're hiring local CPAs to do their work. They're hiring local contractors to do their work. They're using local banks to keep their money. Those local banks are then lending out that money into the local community for local services. And a dollar brought into that local company over the course of a year or 2 years will become far more than a dollar. On the other hand, if an out-of-state corporation comes in that's doing business in multiple state areas that has achieved the efficiencies of scale, the economies of scale that you can do with that, they're not using the local CPAs. They're using, you know, the Bentonville, Arkansas, in the case of Walmart, CPA. They're not using local attorneys. They're not using local contractors. They're not using local architects. They're not using the local banking system. In fact, every night at midnight, they push a button and all the money from that they gathered in the local community gets sucked out of the local community and goes to Bentonville for Walmart or Chicago for McDonald's or whatever. And the only money that comes back into the local community is what they're paying in property taxes and in salaries. In fact, most of the stuff that they're selling is not manufactured locally. But even local businesses that are selling things that aren't manufactured locally are building a local economy. Shouldn't we, the people of the United States of America, have some say, and particularly local communities, shouldn't they have some say over this horrific set of consequences that are brought about by these big box retailers?
Absolutely. The case of San Diego, and the column is in voiceofsandiego.com if anybody wants to go to it, communities should have the say. In the case of San Diego, the city council is going against the voters' wishes and has ruled against Walmart being able to put a big box in. But to pick up, Tom, on what you're saying, should we restrict all retailers to local? I mean, even if it doubles the expense or triples the expense to everybody, or maybe statewide?
Well, first of all, you know it's not going to double or triple the expense. It's going to increase it 5, 10, 15% at the most.
You think?
Yeah, I mean, look at what it used to cost when you used to buy things from the local grocer versus what it costs now when you buy them from the big chains. We're not talking doubling the price or cutting in half the price. We're talking a relatively incremental change.
Well, but I'll betcha your Barnes & Noble sales for your books and your Borders sales are probably... I'll bet the prices that your book sells for in those two stores or at Amazon is well below the independent booksellers. In my case, Warwick's in La Jolla sells my book for $21. You can get it at Amazon used for $8.
So the argument that you're trying to trot out here, Gary Sutton, is that it's better for all of us if local communities get screwed and small businesses get put out of business because we can buy cheaper stuff. But I would say the flip side of that argument, and where that argument just absolutely breaks down, is that, yeah, we can buy cheaper stuff, but we have less income. Our community is being ripped apart. We don't have decent jobs anymore.
I don't quite agree. I wouldn't phrase it the same way, Tom.
Well, you know, the local CPA is out of business. That local CPA was buying, you know, from local businesses. They were patronizing the local restaurants. The local attorneys are out of business. We used to have in most American towns a local economy. I remember back in the 1950s and 60s when you could travel around the United States, and I did, and you could tell immediately what town you were in just by looking around, because everything was the name of the town, everything was local, everything was unique. This country was and there were local economies that were strong, and we had a strong middle class as a consequence of it. Now that is going away. What's happening now is you could drop out of an airplane at 50,000 feet and just land in any random city in America, have no idea where you are, and it might take you a week to figure out where you are until you stumble across something that just by accident has the name of the town on it, because at every corner there's an Olive Tree or a Barnes & Noble or a Borders or a Bed Bath & More or a Walmart or whatever. And I just don't think it's good for America.
Well, what you say is true, and I hate to see that happening. I like the individual characteristics of towns. But
Ben, let's start enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act again.
Well, just watch. There's no way we'll ever see this bet through, but I'll bet in 25 years Walmart will be gone, just like Sears and Kmart. You know, they're both practically dead now. They just haven't admitted it yet.
Well, because they have become the middle-sized fish that are getting eaten by the big fish of Walmart. I mean, what we have with absolute unregulated laissez-faire capitalism, which is what you seem to be advocating, is eventually you have no small fish left, and ultimately not even, you don't even have middle-sized fish left. You end up with just a very, very small number of very large corporations that control pretty much everything, and they have all the economies of scale, and you end up with a very, very wealthy elite that have so much wealth that they are also able then to seize political power. Like, you know, one of the Walton family heirs being the principal funder behind the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth campaign against John Kerry. I mean, you know, this is nuts that we should have such power and wealth in the United States that it can threaten our political process.
Hey, Tom, if we hopped in that time machine and went back 50 years like you nostalgically suggested, there would be a Sears store there. Don't you remember when Sears was viewed as the big evil retailer?
I do.
And they just squeezed their vendors, put some of them out of business.
I do. And I think that, you know, at that point in time, had we said, okay, we've got a problem here, and it's going to get worse if we keep going down this road. We have no problem with Sears opening stores in our local communities, but they have to use local vendors for all their services. They have to use local banking. We could have regulated the rules of business in a way that would keep local communities intact. And actually, a lot of those companies, you know, Woolworth voluntarily did that for a long time in the 40s and 50s.
Yeah, and where are they?
Well, it's been a long time since then, but they were quite successful at that time.
I think there's historical precedent for two attempts at this, and one would be Gandhi, when he encouraged everybody in India to have their own spinning wheels. And that sort of gave the Japanese an edge, and they took over the textile industry. Now, Gandhi, you can't say he...
Well, he was doing that because the British had passed a law saying you couldn't make your own clothes. That's why Gandhi was doing it, that all the fabric had to go to England to be made into clothing to be sold back to the Indians. I mean, that was a protest against colonialism.
He was a great guy. And
you can't compare Gandhi with Walmart.
Pardon?
You're not trying to compare Gandhi with Walmart.
No, don't put those words in my mouth. The other was Mao's Great Leap Forward, when he wanted everybody to have iron smelters in their backyard.
Yeah, well, I'm not a big fan of Mao either.
Yeah,
we'll have to wrap it up there, though. It's an interesting conversation.
Agree on that.
Yeah, there you go. Gary Sutton, his website, MediaCorporateCanaries.com, his book, Corporate Canaries. Gary, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix.
I tell you the truth, baby, I'm no liar. Nobody wins with the world on fire.
Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the place where despair is not an option. It smells like global climactic change, speaking of the world on fire. According to U.S. maritime industry sources, tanker captains, this, by the way, from one of the Indy News centers, the one here in Portland, actually. The environmental surge you're hearing may be a little different. The surge you're hearing may be a little different than the military one that Bush is going to announce tonight. We'll talk about that in a second. We're going to get back to our whole Walmart discussion in just a second. But I want to the bumper music there just got me going. I got to share the song with you or the story with you. According to U.S. maritime industry sources, tanker captains. Now, these giant tankers, you know, liquid natural gas and oil, they have detectors all over the tankers to look for hydrocarbons in the air, because that would mean that the gas is leaking or that the oil is leaking and it's getting into the air, and, you know, it's a fire hazard. So here's back to the story. According to U.S. maritime industry sources, tanker captains are reporting an increase in onboard alarms from hazard sensors designed to detect hydrocarbon gas leaks, and specifically methane leaks. Now, why would that be? Now, the leaks are not emanating from the cargo holds or pump rooms, but from continental shelves venting increasing amounts of trapped methane into the atmosphere. Holy cow. Methane is 21 times more potent a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And with rising ocean temperatures, these methane crystals, these frozen methane crystals, are increasingly melting and escaping into the atmosphere from the ocean. In fact, one of the major sources for increased methane venting is the Hudson Submarine Canyon, which extends into the Atlantic 400 miles from the New York, New Jersey harbor. Now, New York, New Jersey, Weehawken, and Newark, earlier this week, late last week? Anyhow, there's that smell. Remember the smell? Turns out, well, they're saying it's a swamp. Well, it's a swamp because things are melting that shouldn't be melting. And so what's getting into the air is hydrogen sulfide. Hydrogen sulfide is the byproduct of bacterial decomposition of organic matter. But along with it, methane. And methane driving up global warming. Bad cycle. Milton in Northampton, Massachusetts. Hey, Milton, welcome to the program. Thanks for giving us a call. What's up? Milton?
Oh, yeah.
You are on the air.
Hi. Well, I was calling because you have the guy on who likes the corporate takeover in the country.
Yes. The wonders of big box companies.
That's right.
Milton? We seem to have lost Milton, so... Anyhow, here what I want to share with you about this is just this is a quick quote from. I'll tell you in just a second who it's from. Well, no, I'll start right now. This is George Robert Twelvetree Hughes, back in 1773, at the age of 16 or 17, was one of the guys who went and threw the tea in the Boston Harbor. He's the only one who ever wrote about it. The only biography or autobiography about the Boston Tea Party. This is from his book. The East India Company received permission to transport tea free of all duty from Great Britain to America. He's talking about the Tea Act of 1773. It was a tax cut for the East India Company, allowing it to wipe out its small competitors and take over the tea business in all of America. Hence, it was no longer the small vessels of private merchants who went to vend tea for their own account in the ports of the colonies, but on the contrary, ships of an enormous burthen that transported immense quantities of this commodity, which by the aid of the public authority might as easily be, easily be landed and amassed in suitable warehouses. Accordingly, the company sent its agents at Boston, New York, Philadelphia, 600 chests of tea and a proportionate number to Charleston and other maritime cities in the American continent. The colonies were now arrived at the decisive moment when they must cast the die and determine their course. You get it? This is all about the Walmartization of North America. The Boston Tea Party was the first anti-Walmart, or the first anti-big multinational. It was the first Seattle WTO protest. He talks about it. He says, in New York, Captain Sears and McDougal, daring and enterprising men, effected a concert of will against the East India Company between the smugglers, the merchants, and the Sons of Liberty, who had all joined forces and in most cases were the same people. Pamphlets suited to the conjecture were daily distributed. Nothing was left unattempted by popular leaders to obtain their purpose. That from Robert XII, he uses his autobiography. Resistance was organized and growing. The citizens of the colonies preparing to throw off one of the corporations that for almost 200 years had determined nearly every aspect of their lives through its economic and political power. These guys were planning to destroy the goods of one of the largest multinational corporations in the world, intimidate its employees, and face down the guns of the government that supported it. That was the Boston Tea Party. It started the American Revolution. And the basis of it? We want local communities to be able to have local businesses, small businesses. We don't want the East India Company shoving tax-subsidized or tax-cut, you know, with their giant tax cuts and their huge economies of scale, these ships of enormous burthen, to quote Hughes. We don't want the East India Company shoving this stuff down our throat anymore. What's Gordon Smith up to, and why is it different from Mitt Romney? What could that have to do with the war? We'll get into that right after this. 27 minutes past the hour.
The festival was over and the boys were all planning for a fall. The cabaret was quiet except for the drilling in the wall. The curtain had been lifted and the gambling wheel shut down. Anyone with any sense had already left town. He was standing in the doorway looking like the Jack of Hearts.
And welcome back. The Pillow will help you escape the Matrix, the Tom Hartman program. Speaking of the Jack of Hearts here, Tony Snow. This is incredible. This is just incredible. We just found that 2006 was one of the warmest years in history here in the continental United States. It was the warmest year in history. And then they get into, and also NBC News now reporting, Bush is going to ask for 21,500 troops tonight, 17,500 for Baghdad, 4,000 for Anbar province, $6.8 billion it's going to cost. And then Tony Snow, you know, well, let's also fight the culture wars, right? Only again, with nonsense. He held a press briefing this morning and said, the vast majority of breakthroughs right now, virtually all, have involved those other than embryonic stem cells. No, sorry, Tony, you are wrong. I mean, it's just, there are some times where you just have to figure, it's a Tony Snow alert. Yes, Tony Snow, the vast majority of breakthroughs right now, virtually all, have involved those other than embryonic stem cells. I'm sorry, Tony. Just hear some news stories compiled over at thinkprogress.org. June 20th, 2006, CBS reports that ES cells, embryonic stem cells, have been used to help paralyzed rats walk. On July 5th, 2006, Science Daily reports that embryonic stem cells have been used to create T cells which could cure AIDS. In July 11th, 2006, The Guardian reports that embryonic stem cells have been used to create sperm that successfully fertilized mouse eggs could aid those with infertility. On September 21st, 2006, Washington Post reports that embryonic stem cells have been used to slow vision loss in rats. October 23rd, 2006, Washington Post reports that embryonic stem cells have been used to reduce the symptoms of Parkinson's disease in rats. October 31st, 2006, The New Scientist reports that embryonic stem cells have been used to create insulin-secreting cells, which can be used to treat diabetes. November 10th, 2006. Nature reports that embryonic stem cells have been used to make a vaccine that protects mice from lung cancer. November 22nd, 2006. The New Scientist reports that embryonic stem cells have been used to create cardiovascular precursor cells, which can be used to treat heart disease. Now, that's just the last couple months. That's just the last couple months. And Tony Snow's like, oh, no. These guys, they are so desperate to pander to their base, or what they perceive as their base, to this right-wing fringe. The American Taliban, let's call them what they are, the American Taliban, that they will lie about science. They will lie. It's just tragic. Speaking of religion, Gordon Smith, Republican congressman, or senator from Oregon, coming out and opposing escalation of the war.
The more the Congress can be involved in the decision-making, the better. And that's what the American people are asking for. They're going to hold us accountable, then let's have the tools of accountability so we can be held responsible.
Interesting. Now, Jeannie Berg, blogging over at blueoregon.com, says, Gordon Smith on Iraq, did the elders make him do it? And now this, I thought this was fascinating because it hadn't occurred to me that it was a possibility. She says, it's no surprise that Gordon Smith is opposing the troop surge now that he's gotten the go-ahead from the Mormon leadership. A troop surge would be hard to support given Mormon prophet Gordon Hinckley's comments about war. Quote, what a fruitless thing it so often is and what a terrible price it extracts, end quote. So did Gordon Smith's recent announcement of his newfound opposition to the Iraq war happen because his feelings changed? Because he came to terms with the political realities in Oregon? Or because he was following the lead of the man he really answers to, Mormon prophet Gordon Hinckley? There's been much discussed about the motives behind Senator Smith's about-face on the Iraq war, but all of it has missed one important factor in the senator's decision-making, his serious commitment to the Mormon Church. Smith's Mormon commitment is real and deep. This commitment may be a part of what makes Smith the super straight-laced guy many admire, but it also means he has great loyalty to the Mormon leadership. Damon Linker, writing about another Mormon political leader, Mitt Romney, in this week's New Republic, says, quote, the man who holds the office of the president of the LDS Church is now considered to be a prophet, or is also considered to be a prophet, the mouthpiece of God on earth, in the words of Mormon theologian and apostle Bruce McConkie, whose statements override both scripture and tradition, end quote. And then Jeannie Berg writes, in my recent research, I found that President Hinckley, as he's referred to in the church, the Mormon Church had strongly supported the war in Iraq before the invasion and during the first phase of the occupation. Bush showed his gratitude to Hinckley by awarding him the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor, and granting him several private audiences, the last of which was in August of 2006. But at the time of their last meeting, Hinckley's views had already started to change. Mike Wallace reported Hinckley's growing discomfort with the war as early as the summer of 2005. And Gordon Smith recently told the New York Times that he began to move to opposition to the war soon after. Then on October 31st, 2006, Hinckley delivered and addressed over 20,000 students at BYU, Brigham Young University, that was reported as a denunciation of the war in the Mormon-owned press. Just 1 month later, Smith, one of the nation's most devoutly Mormon politicians, followed suit and denounced the war as well. So was it a change of heart, political expediency, which has been my theory all along, or allegiance to the man he regards as the voice of God for our time that motivated Gordon Smith's reversal on the war? Good question. But another prominent Mormon, Mitt Romney, has broken his silence on the escalation. He released a written statement this morning. Quote, in consultation with generals, military experts, and troops who have served on the ground in Iraq, I believe securing Iraqi civilians requires additional troops. Success will require rapid deployment. So Mitt Romney is in favor of escalating the war. So maybe he doesn't believe that President Hinckley of the church, Prophet Gordon Hinckley, is the voice of God on earth, or maybe he's not as good an observing Mormon as Gordon Smith, or maybe it's got nothing to do with Mormonism whatsoever. But it's an interesting dimension to it that, frankly, I had not considered before I read this piece this morning in Blue Oregon. I'd wondered to what extent Smith's and Romney's, and for that matter, Harry Reid, who's also a Mormon, to what extent their faith, because the Mormon faith is a very, kind of intrusive in your life. I mean, you're either really there or you're really not. Whether it's storing up a year's worth of food in for the end of days or whatever, doing your missionary work. I don't pretend to be an expert on Mormonism. This is not meant to be an endorsement or an attack. I just, but it's real. It's there. Interesting thoughts. So that, the big box companies, the speech tonight, lots of stuff on the agenda. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Steve in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Getting back to the big box retailers.
Sure.
I've been really trying to get into local politics or try to pay attention to it. And let me tell you something. National politics is easy compared to local politics. For whatever reason, local politics, you're basically telling people what they can and can't do with their own land,
Mm-hmm.
And so local economic development's of great interest to me. As you know, here in suburban Atlanta, we're experiencing severe sprawl. The counties they get built up, the subdivisions get built up, and then, of course, people need places to buy goods. And so your Barnes and Nobles and your Best Buys, they can come in easily and supply that stuff where no local businesses really were to begin with.
Right.
So how do you encourage local businesses? Now, before you mentioned having requirements of these big box stores that to use local banks, et cetera, that's the first time I've ever heard of that. Can you recommend good group or website or read that talks about this kind of stuff?
I don't know of anybody who ever has. I mean, it's my idea. I mean, it may be somebody else's idea. It might, there might be 100 other variations of it out there. And frankly, I guess to the extent that I got it from somebody, I got it from Teddy Roosevelt. In my book on equal protection, I quote at length from some of Teddy Roosevelt's speeches where he talks about, the virtues of small business and medium-sized business and how they recycle into the community and they build the community and the benefit of a small business owner having to face his own or her own employees every day and behave like a human being toward them. And then in this one particular speech of Roosevelt's, I remember so clearly, it'd take me a minute to find it in the book, but he says, "And now I will talk about big business." And he says, "Here we have, a threat. This is something that, that needs to be narrowly circumscribed." And Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican Roosevelt, the trust buster, then goes off on this rant about how big business can be so destructive to communities, it can be so destructive to economies, and ultimately it can be destructive to democracy if it's not controlled and regulated. And so that was, what I was tossing out in that conversation was just an idea that's been rolling around in my mind for a long time. I mean, it's one of a lot of different ways that you could do it. I think, frankly, using the Sherman Act to break up some of these large companies is a better means, but that's one step.
Okay, I got you. I just couldn't think of any way.
Here's a variation. When I lived in Montpelier, Vermont, mm-hmm. the state capital, it's the only state capital in the United States with no McDonald's. Why? Because through zoning, and maybe you could do this with zoning, through zoning they said, you can't have a license to operate a restaurant unless you have table service and you bake bread on the premises. And because none of the big, chain restaurants were either willing or able to do that, there are no fast food restaurants in Montpelier. There's no, it's the only state capital with no McDonald's. And something that, folks in Vermont are quite proud of. And so, I think it's possible that there's a lot that can be done at the local level, Steve, and I encourage you to do it. And good on you for getting involved in local politics. 45 minutes past the hour.
I stoke the mighty furnaces and roll the flaming steel. I operated oil rigs and wells. And when the country needed them, I built the planes and tanks to send the tyrants down to fry in hell. I'm the man that built the bridges. I'm the man that laid the track. I'm the man that built this country with my shoulders and my back. I'm the man that built the power dams and oiled all the cars. And I laid down the cornerstones of this great land of ours.
And welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, talking back to the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Kathy in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Kathy.
Hello?
Hi. You're live on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'm probably one of the few liberal Mormons who actually listen to your radio show. I'm sure that most of them are at the Rush Limbaugh, Bill O'Reilly spot.
Oh,
but your comment about the officials who really listen more to the president than they do to their constituents, and that's what
the president of the church, you mean?
One of the reasons I did leave Utah finally, because it just seemed like the politics were so geared towards the separation of church and state just wasn't there, I found. Mm. And it was getting a little frustrating. So we moved to Washington, and we have found it to be, there's still pockets of all through Washington.
So do you think, Kathy, that Gordon Smith's conversion on the war is a result of the prophet, the president of the Mormon Church's change of heart on the war?
I do. President Hinckley, and I'm Mormon, and I still practice. Like I said, I'm just more liberal. And so, mm-hmm. but I love President Hinckley. I think he's a great guy. But I do feel that when President Hinckley says something that their followers.
Then why is Mitt Romney ignoring it?
Excuse me? Yes, he is.
Why would Mitt Romney then go against his church?
Well, I'm not sure why, because that's unusual. Maybe he's catering more to where he's living.
Maybe he wants to be president, a Republican president, more than he wants to be a good Mormon.
Possibly, but yeah. I tell you, to be honest with you, I can't ever I could never see a Mormon person being in the presidency just because I think Mormonism, the LDS Church, is still very cultish looking to the outside world, I believe, in my opinion.
There is that perception. Yeah, I think that you're right that there is that perception, although it has become also more mainstream. I mean, my first contact, I suppose, was in Marriott hotels, always finding the Book of Mormon in them, but discovering that was. In any case, Kathy, thank you so much for the call. Appreciate it.
Bye.
Good to hear from you, Bob in Westport. I'm sorry, here we Bob's not available yet. Mike, driving in Washington. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Well, I have two questions, and one of them is exactly what happens if the Congress declares war. In other words, what little bells and whistles go off that are different than normal? And the other one is, it seems to me that if it says in the Constitution that the Congress can declare war, it seems to me the Congress can undeclare war.
Yes,
thank
you're
you
right.
Much.
You're right. Yeah, you're right, Mike, and thank you for the call. Now, Congress has the power to regulate what Bush can do. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. They have the authority to say no to this guy. And, whether they're going to do it or not is a whole other thing. But they very definitely have that power, as Ted Kennedy pointed out yesterday. Bob in Albany, New York. Hey, Bob.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good. What's up?
I was just calling in after your spiel about the embryonic stem cell research being used in so many different instances. And all I'd like to point out is, has it been proven to help at all in any of those instances?
Yes.
Yes, really. Which one?
You mean for humans? Or for mammals? No, none of this work has progressed to human beings yet, but embryonic stem cells with rats have helped paralyzed rats walk. They have helped rats who have been ravaged with AIDS create T cells and fight off the AIDS. They've recreated sperm in mice that have been in mice deal with infertility. They've been able to reverse vision loss in rats. They've reduced the symptoms of Parkinson's disease in rats. Obviously, all these things, you do the mammal work first before you do the human work. This is something that's not going to happen tomorrow. But if any of these kinds of dramatic changes have been happening with anything other than stem cells, with anything non-controversial, everybody would be falling all over themselves to make it happen. And they are with them as well, frankly, in my opinion. OMD in Springfield, Oregon. Hey, OMD, what's up?
Yes, back to stem cells again. You're falling into the trap that George Lakoff talked about on framing the debate. They are not embryonic stem cells. They're stem cells. And yeah, that's the power of what they've done through all these years.
No, but there is a difference between stem cells that are derived from unused embryos and stem cells that are derived from, example, cord blood, which is what's in the news right now, or stem cells that are derived from bone marrow. You have stem cells in your body right now. Every time you go out and give blood, you actually increase the number of circulating stem cells in your bloodstream. One of the reasons that a lot of people are speculating that men and non-menstruating women who give blood at least once a year have a 25% lower risk of dying from most causes, including diseases like cancer, because it causes your red blood cells to throw off more stem cells that help heal your own body.
True, but see, that's what they're talking about. The stem cells are a blastocyst. The embryo is a totally different thing.
Right, but
they're
the stem cell
term,
is...
They're using that term embryos to put you against it.
Remember well,
what Daryl Lakoff said, framing the debate. The embryonic is their key word. Yeah.
Yeah, well, okay. I don't buy it, OMD, but, you know, George is often right, but I think that it's important that we actually say that we claim embryonic stem cell research. Because that is where it appears, according to the scientists. I mean, yeah, I actually, you know, I'm a AAAS member. I get Science Magazine. You read these reports, and I get New Scientist, and I get Nature, and you read these reports, and this is where the most exciting and promising and rapid research is coming from, is that work which is being done on stem cells that are derived from blastocysts, from arguably embryonic stem cells. 57 minutes past there. We'll continue this debate right after the news. Stick around.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Okay, let's see here. Whose language are we using? I'm looking at religioustolerance.org. There's a great website that goes through the whole definition of, you know, what's what, when, where, with all this. This is all about this embryonic stem cell thing, or is it a zygote stem cell thing, or should it be the blast stem cell thing? Should we try and change the language, or, you know, sometimes I think you just, hey, you know, okay, the other side got their language, they got the meme out there. The pro-life people who are only actually anti-abortion, they're not pro-life. Yeah, they got their meme out there. Yes, as soon as you use that phrase, you're using their frame, and that helps them win the bet. I agree. George Lakoff is right. And you have to deal with the fact that the media has picked that up, and it is now the frame. So we start out, let's see here. Looking at this website. A woman ovulates and produces one mature ovum, an egg cell, travels down the fallopian tubes. Some scientists have described an ovum as an inert globule of organic matter. It does, however, carry a cargo of human DNA. Then it gets fertilized by a sperm in the fallopian tubes. And now it is called a zygote. It is a genetically unique entity. It has DNA from both the sperm and its own from the ovum, and now we have a zygote, sometimes referred to as a fertilized ovum. It's interesting. The zygote, this arguably scientific definition, it, biologically you could say it's alive. It fulfills the four criteria: metabolism, growth, reaction, stimuli, and reproduction. It can reproduce itself through twinning at any time up to 14 days after conception. This is how identical twins are. That's really stretching it, in my opinion. But anyhow, this is where the anti-abortion groups say, oh yeah, this is the beginning of life. Now the zygote then divides itself into two cells called blastomeres. And they divide once again every 12 to 20 hours as the zygote slowly passes down the fallopian tubes. 3 days after conception, it's now 16 cells. It's called a 16-cell morula. And at that point, a cavity forms. A grouping of cells are now called a blastocyst. And there's an inner shell and an outer shell to the blastocyst. So which, here's the language. What do you want to call these things if you're not going to call them embryonic stem cells? The inside of the blastocyst, by the way, is what begins to form the embryo. The outer cell, called the trophoblast, start to form the placenta. This is still referred to as a pre-embryo. We're still talking about, you know, something less than about the size of the period at the end of a sentence, you could call it a blastocyst. Okay, so shall we start calling them blastocystic stem cells? I don't know. I'm not ready to try to reinvent this the language. I'm frankly more concerned about what's going to happen tonight when George Bush gets out there and gives his speech and tries to get this war going. Chris in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Chris, what are your thoughts on this?
Hi, Tom. I'm kind of piggybacking on Tony Snow saying whatever he wants to say. On the eve of the president's speech, everyone gave him a free pass when he blatantly lied and said, Rumsfeld will be with me. And he spent the whole campaign saying, we've got a plan, I've got a plan, the Democrats don't have a plan.
Yeah, just here like Nixon are. Did in 72.
Yeah, and here we are. 2 months later, he spent the whole time listening and figuring things out. Apparently, he didn't have a plan, and he had no problem saying he did. So.
Yeah.
I haven't heard anyone talking about that.
What's going to be real interesting tonight, Chris, is to listen to the subtext to Bush's speech about whether the subtext is, I'm going to go ahead and do this anyway because I got enough, you know, surplus money floating around in the Pentagon. I don't need any authorization to do it, and this falls within the purview of the authorization I already have, or whether the subtext is, I would like congressional approval for this. I'm assuming it's going to be the former. I'd be shocked if it was the latter, but it really should be the latter. I mean, it really should be that Congress determines these things. So we'll see how it all shakes out. Chris, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, welcome to the program.
You know, I'd love it once in my life to hear Bush come out and say the truth, and he'd say it's not about weapons of mass destruction because we sold Saddam all the weapons he had.
Yeah.
And it's not about freedom because our best friends and partners are the Saudis. And if you want democracy, you might lose your head over it there.
Oh, just walk into the country of the Bible, they'll chop your head off.
What it's really all about, and it's not about winning the peace. I think if he really came out and told the truth, he'd say it's not about winning peace and all those other things. That's all lies. It's all about winning the lease for the oil company monopolies that run him.
Yes. Amen. And in fact, that's, I mean, you know, ultimately that's what it gets right down to here. That's
the least.
You have identified the absolute bottom line, Armin, and that's
the least.
Thank you very much. The modern oil industry, you know, this whole thing. In fact, you have to consider that ultimately we are made of oil. And yeah, I know, you know, Dick Cheney has his.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, Dick Cheney has his thoughts on this, but we really are made out of oil. The food that we eat is the product of oil to a large extent. Our clothing, much of it is made from oil, and that which is not made from oil is ultimately made from oil. Like I'm wearing a wool sweater, for example. You say that's not made out of oil. Yeah, I would submit to you that in all probability, the sheep that were shorn to make the wool for this sweater were probably fed food that was grown using factory chemicals and fertilizers and transported and whatnot with oil. I mean, the sheep were made out of oil in that regard. And then the sweater was made with oil, and then it was transported with oil. I mean, our housing is oil. And all of this stuff. And so our dependence on oil, our oil has so interpenetrated our culture that when you get these statements, I mean, here, the Turkish Weekly, for example, this is, you know, referring to the article. I shared the article in The Independent with you a couple of days ago, you know, when it first came out, the Sunday Independent. And now it's being picked up in the Middle East. This is from the Journal of the Turkish Weekly. They write, the UK's Independent on Sunday wrote that, unnoticed by most amid the furor over civil war in Iraq and the hanging of Saddam Hussein, the new oil law has quietly been going through several drafts and will be shortly presented to the cabinet and then the parliament in Baghdad. Its provisions are a radical departure from the norm for developing countries. Under a system known as production sharing agreements, or PSAs, oil majors such as BP and Shell in Britain and Exxon and Chevron in the U.S. will be able to sign deals up to 30 years to extract oil, Iraq's oil. And, you know, they just go through this whole thing about how this is not the way it's typically done. It also wrote, critics fear that given Iraq's bargaining position, although it holds the third largest oil reserves in the world, estimated 115 billion barrels to be extracted, it could get locked into these bad deals. Is it all about oil? They point out Dick Cheney, back in 1999, when he was running as when he was president of Halliburton, he said, by 2010, we will need a further 50 million barrels a day. The Middle East, with two-thirds of the world's oil and the lowest cost, is still where the prize lies. I mean, that's Dick Cheney. So, is it about oil? Mike in Los Angeles, you disagree with me.
Hey, I was thinking what the similarity between the Christian crusades back in the 1000 AD or so have with the what's going on in Iraq. And it's not about oil. They're not similar, but the idea of world domination, or at least dominating your neighbor, that's the similarity. And whether we dominate Iraq or Venezuela or China and being to be number one, that's what this is all about.
I don't disagree with you at all, Mike, but let's add to that the fact that one of the most powerful tools of domination is controlling the energy supply. That's the currency of our world today, not gold, oil.
Gold?
Not gold, oil. The main currency of the world today, you can sit on gold all day long, it's going to do you no good. If you've got oil, you can produce food.
Ideas is the main value in any age. Not gold, not oil, not wheat.
Well, but the fact of the matter is that the world's population right now, it's 6 billion plus people, is only possible because of oil. Without oil, or some form of ancient sunlight, oil, coal, gas, the world couldn't support over a billion people. I mean, it's real simple. I'll give you the population numbers when we come back. And I also want to share with you, Mike, something I think you may find, again, consistent with your worldview. Cindy Sheehan talking about why George Bush made his invasion of Iraq. And what's going on with this invasion of Iraq? Our number, 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM, 16 minutes past the hour.
Demand is up, supplies are down. What I want is like crude and brown. I crave oil to get my kicks. Attack Iraq to get my fix. I love oil, oh, every ounce. Nuclear, I can't pronounce. When my twins go out for fun, I say don't drive. Take Air Force One. Oh, we can't conserve it. We are just
and welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors. Listen carefully to the local sponsors on your radio station. You want to make progressive radio work? Support the sponsors. It's just that simple, as well as our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, sacredgroundscoffee.com, all fair trade, all organic, or Small Dog Electronics, one of the nation's leading Mac dealers at smalldog.com, or the Organic Wine Company at ecowine.com, 1-888-ECO-WINE. George W. Bush, when he was giving his speech declaring that he was about to invade Iraq, turns to the camera and says, "Now I'd like to talk to the Iraqi people." And we're all figuring, okay, he's going to say, you know, we're the biggest military machine in the world. Lay down your arms and we won't kill your kids. Nobody wants to die in war. Our kids don't want to die in war. Your kids don't want to die in war. But instead, he says to the camera,
"Your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells."
And all over the world, people went, oh. And as I said, this is what Cindy Sheehan, she was testifying before John Conyers Commission investigating the Bush, basically investigating the invasion of Iraq.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend, Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated.
Now just let me just reaffirm, reconfirm here what Cindy Sheehan did in the setup. Mickey Herskowitz was the guy that the Bush family, he's an old Bush family friend, he's the guy that was hired by the Bush family to write, to ghostwrite George Bush's autobiography called A Charge to Keep, which you can find in bookstores right now. He wrote the first draft of it. Then they brought in another writer to write the second draft because the first draft didn't suck up enough. And he interviewed Bush for hours. My recollection is there was 60 hours of audio tape. Might have been 20 hours. It was one or the other. In any case, he interviewed him for hours and hours and hours. He had all these audio tapes. And then after he was, you know, off the job and off the project and, frankly, rather disillusioned with Bush, he shared this story with the press. This is not Cindy Sheehan's story. This is right out of the press. It's just, you know, she tells it really well. She's quoting now George Bush in 1999 as governor, talking to the guy who's writing his autobiography.
One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I have that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency, end quote.
And then Cindy Sheehan adds tragically,
it looks like George Bush was ready to lead this country into an avoidable war even before he became president.
Yeah, and there's the fact. I mean, just the very simple fact. So what is this successful presidency that Bush wanted to have? Well, we know back in 1977 when he ran for the United States House of Representatives unsuccessfully. This is a guy who never succeeded at anything he did in his whole entire life. When he ran for the House of Representatives, the major cornerstone of his campaign was rolling back Social Security, privatizing Social Security. That's the bottom line. The whole economic agenda of the New Deal, what Roosevelt did, is what these guys want to roll back. The cons and the neocons, it's all about rolling back the New Deal. And part of that has to do with the control of oil. As Limbaugh loves to say,
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
So up until the era of oil, up until Colonel Drake drilled the first oil well in Titusville, Pennsylvania in 1856, up until that time, up until 1800, the world's population never exceeded a billion humans. Because that's basically all the food we could grow. Then we started using oil to grow more food and other fossil fuels to be able to cut down our forests. We didn't need wood to heat with, and we could grow food. And so our second billion was in 1930. It only took, 130 years, from 1800, 1 billion, to 2 billion, 1930. Our third billion only took 30 years, 1960. The fourth billion, 14 years, 1974. The fifth billion, 1987, 13 years. The sixth billion, only 11 years, 1999. That explosion of population, that additional 5 billion people, all since the discovery of oil or the widespread use of oil, is because the food supply is being driven by the availability of oil. As I said, we are made out of oil in a very real way, at a very real level. And boom, here we are. And so if you control the oil, you control the food supply. You control the food supply. You control everything.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserves, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, and so guess who controls the oil? So, I guess Mike or Mark, I'm forgetting your name, I'm agreeing with you that it's all about the power, and I'm saying that the oil is all about the power. It's all about both. And there's an awful lot of money to be made with that oil, too. And money is all about the power. Time right now for the Tom Hartman Program's Progressive Pop Quiz. Our question for the day today, the National Climate Data Center says last year was the record year for what? The sixth caller with the correct answer at 866-440-8466. 440-THOM gets an autographed and personalized copy of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. The answer coming up right after the break, 27 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, Viagra for your brain. Just don't tell Limbaugh, he'll want some.
Hello, good evening. Welcome to the 6 o'clock news.
At 6 o'clock.
President Bush's surprise message. America is addicted to...
Today, they say the danger's gone our way.
Saturday night.
And he's going to be whistling it up again tonight. Mr. Bush, George Bush. This is a guy who believes, and I'm not saying this as a slam on George Bush. I'm really not one of those people who's, Bush can do no wrong, you know, quack, 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 or I hate Bush, or anything. No. But look at the history of this guy. He is one of those folks, and there's a small group of people, I think there's a subculture of people like this. He's one of those, that small group of people who believes that the solution to all problems is to kill somebody. I realize that sounds simplistic, but as governor of Texas, he put to death, what, 123 people, 135, whatever it was, executed people. He was very proud of the fact that more people, he put to death more people in Texas than any governor ever had in the history of the United States, and that he never spent more than 5 minutes, never spent more than 20 minutes, and typically not more than 5 minutes, evaluating an execution order. Because he believes that one of the ways you solve problems, probably the most effective way you solve problems, is you kill people. People are problematic, kill them. So he's killed 600,000 Iraqis. Well, you know, if it makes the world safe, we're going to kill Osama bin Laden. We're going to hunt this guy down and kill him. What did we have yesterday in Somalia? We tracked a guy down with the aid of the Somali government. I mean, he was right there in the country. They could have arrested him. No, let's kill him. Drop a bomb on a building and kill a whole bunch of other people along with it. All this collateral damage. There's a danger to that worldview. Anyhow, welcome back. 36 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. We have a winner in our progressive pop quiz. Our question, the National Climate Data Center says last year was a record year for what? Congratulations to Jeffrey Harp of East Hampton in Massachusetts. And congratulations to Jeffrey. WHMP, I believe, is the call letters for that station. Jeffrey knew that the answer is temperature, warmth. Last year, a record year for heat on the planet. And good on you, Jeffrey. He wins a autographed and personalized copy of my new book, Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Ted, listening in KOPT in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Ted, what's up?
I was calling about Wolfowitz's writings in the 70s, and also in 1992, he wrote a defense planning guidance that was leaked to the New York Times, which basically said that we're interested in preserving the unipolar moment.
Yes, this is the worldview that is a variation on what I was just talking about. Bush's, you know, if there's a problem, kill people. And it's fundamentally, I think, a very, very insecure and oddly, probably typically male, but very insecure worldview, which is that we're frightened, therefore we have to control everything around us. The control freaks are typically the most frightened people. And Wolfowitz's worldview, the neocon worldview, the Bush worldview, is that we must absolutely control and dominate everything around us. And I mean, you saw the Republicans play this thing out in the House and Senate over the last 5 years.
Right. Control over the Persian Gulf oil is the key to controlling Germany and Japan and China.
Yep.
Because if you control the spigot, then you control their industrialization.
And this is one of the reasons why China is cutting deals right now with Iran and with the Stan countries and with Russia, you know, and the Ukraine. I mean, why they're trying to get into the Caspian Sea so aggressively is just on the chance that we're going to end up controlling the Persian Gulf.
Right. And if you look at the PNAC website, they're as concerned about China as they are about Iraq.
Yeah, yeah. I agree with you, Ted. Ted, thanks a lot for the call, and, you know, point well made. Alex in Scottsdale, Arizona, listening on KPHX. Hey, Alex.
Good morning. Good morning, Tom.
Hey.
Do you remember Gulf War One?
I do. I mean, I wasn't. I didn't fight in it or anything, but I was alive and paying attention. Yeah.
Well, there was a president that had some problem with these guys, like this green and skunk guy that liked to go into houses and rape 14-year-old girls and kill the family and then douse gasoline on them.
Alex, get right to the point here. I don't know where you're going with this, and I don't know
where I was going to go with this is Saddam had the same problem in Kuwait.
Which problem? The problem was what?
Well, what his soldiers were raping and pillaging in Kuwait.
Sure, happens. That typically happens in wars.
Okay, so what happened was is Saddam had them all lined up, found out every one of them was, and he personally shot him himself. There was no trial. There was nothing. And after that, he didn't have any more raping and pillaging.
Right.
So I was just thinking, you know, I mean, George is into killing and stuff like that. Why doesn't he personally go out and take these guys out himself, you know?
He hasn't killed Lindy England, but I would say in a way he has killed Lindy England. He's making sure that the folks at the very low end are taking the responsibility for what's happened. It's an interesting metaphor. I think it's a bit of a stretch, frankly. Cynthia in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, on WPTT. Hey, Cynthia.
Hey, Tom. Black woman calling from Pittsburgh. I'm glad you mentioned Somalia. Please tell me, what is the wisdom of installing the warlords that drove us out?
They're not Muslim.
Oh my God.
I mean, that's the bottom line, Cynthia. I'm sure you're familiar with that. I wasn't sure,
and I was going to look it up today. You know, what was the difference? So the man that we have installed now is not a Muslim.
Right. The warlords in Somalia are not Muslim. There was this Muslim council that was sort of rising to power, and it was actually a fairly moderate group. It was an anti-Taliban group or an anti-Al-Qaeda group, if my recollection serves me right. And even they were too Muslim for the Bush administration.
And I read a good article by Eric Margolis about this blundering into Somalia. Everybody should look at that.
Yes.
I'm astounded. And here's this black woman they're parading out that's supposed to convince the rest of us that this was a good idea. It is not. I'm just astounded, Tom. Yeah.
No, this is another example. This is Bush using violence, using war, when diplomacy is what we should be using. We should be bringing the countries in the region together. We should be, we should be creating a diplomatic resolution to this and helping, build the economies of these countries. And I mean, there's so many things that could be done rather than just dropping a bomb on a building and then,
Another question. Could this possibly be a launch pad for our attack on Iran? I mean, they give us airspace or something.
There is some concern that controlling East Africa could provide us with a launching pad or with a stepping off point. And there's also some thought that East Africa may have oil reserves beyond what we know about.
Definitely.
So who knows?
Thanks.
Cynthia, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, good to hear from you. Mike in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Mike.
Yeah, hi. Tom, I wanted to kind of disabuse you of this notion of global warming, but I kind of wanted to tie that into a broader theme. First of all, it's important to understand that Bush and the people behind him, the people that install the Bushes and Blairs and Clintons of the world, they've studied their Hegel. Specifically, they understand that you need to control perception. You need to create the perception of a problem. And if you want to create a global government, you need to create global problems that require world government type solutions.
Well, on a smaller scale, I mean, Hegel wasn't the first to talk about that. Plato did. Machiavelli certainly did. I mean, this is nothing new.
Yeah.
You don't have to go to the 19th century for it.
Sure. Yeah, they've read their Plato as well, the Republic in particular, that there should be two classes of people, or three classes, the ruling elite, the guys in uniform who maintain order, and then the rest of us, the
serfs. Yeah. People think Plato was an advocate of democracy. He was not. He was an opponent of democracy. But we digress. Mike, what's your point?
Global warming is a fabrication of the big corporations that I presume you guys detest.
Then why is you mean a fabrication as in a fiction?
Yes, there may be. I used to be a geophysicist for about 10 years with an oil company. There may be some very slight increases in temperature, but
then why are glaciers all over the planet retreating? Why is the mountain that I live next to, Mount Hood, lost 30% of its glacier mass in the last 15 years compared to about a 3% loss over the last 3,000 years?
Well, you've got local variations, and you've got
why is it happening in Kilimanjaro as well?
Well, like I said, there are a lot of cycles, not all of which we understand.
Yeah.
I mean, you had a mini ice age from 1350 to the mid-1800s.
I'm not buying it. I'm just not buying it. Kate in Arcata, California. Hey, Kate.
Oh, hi, Tom. I think this isn't why I called, but I wanted to say another effective way that Bush sees to solve problems is to steal from other people. And I've been asking myself, you know, I sense another motivation coming from the neocons. And I think, you know, that they genuinely believe there's a problem, and so that they see a negative vision of the future. And the vision is that it'll be a fight for resources, and we're going to have to be fighting and controlling everything, rather than a positive vision that we'll all be sharing, we'll have to share the wealth.
Yeah, well, and the unfortunate reality, Kate, is that there is some truth to their vision. It's just that their response to it
exactly.
is what's pathological. Kate, thank you very much for the call. It's psychopathological. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
We'll be formed in opposition, like a rainbow coalition, a same voice in the wilderness of war. And we were winning at the centers when we called our representatives, but they fixed the game and lied about the score. Will this I know?
This I know.
Will this I know?
This I know.
Will humanity may have never sunk so low? Well, there might be a solution. Let's bring on a revolution, because the royalty oligarchy's got to go.
Ah, yes, off with the ruling oligarchy! Welcome back, my friends.
9 minutes before the hour, coming up there on Tom Hartman here with you in the Darwinian world of ideas. We're at the top of the food chain here on the Tom Hartman program. Victoria Jones, speaking of the top of the food chain, Victoria Jones with us with the Talk Radio News Service, one of the finest reporters in one of the finest businesses in one of the strangest cities in America, the belly of the beast, Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, thank you for those kind words. I appreciate that.
Well, it's you know, I'm just continually honored that every day I get to talk to an actual accredited White House press pass. I mean, just the and you're there and you're a progressive and you know what's going on, and Tony Snow has to take your questions, and I'm just, you know, so what's the latest thing we need to cringe about today?
Well, did you know that there's this new plan that we're going to hear about tonight?
Yeah, I've heard rumors.
The plan. Well, I've got the popcorn, I've got the Diet Coke, and I'm ready to go.
Yeah, I have a question about that. I mentioned it to my listeners here at the beginning of the last hour, and that is what I'm going to be listening for tonight, and maybe I don't even need to listen for it, maybe you can just tell me in advance, is whether Bush is going to position his call for more troops, his escalation bid here, whether he's going to position this as, I'd like to do this, will Congress please cooperate and go along and help me out, or is he going to position it as, I'm going to do this because I have already the authority to make war, and, you know, Congress gave it to me years ago, and so I'm just letting you guys know what I'm going to do.
Well, I mean, we certainly haven't been told one way or the other exactly what he's going to say, but my guess would be, based on previous speeches and the way that he has framed things, that he would not be framing it in a way that would imply that he has to seek permission for anything whatsoever.
Yeah. So then Teddy Kennedy, Carl Levin, I mean, there's been a bunch of senators and members of Congress, even some Republicans, I mean, Gordon Smith today have come out and said, we should hold hearings, we should have a vote on this. We should decide. I mean, this is what the Constitution calls for. The Constitution defines that the power to make law, to make war, rests exclusively with the House of Representatives and the United States Senate, with Congress, and not with the President. That any bill that creates war has to be revisited. Any funding bill for war has to be revisited every 2 years. It's right there in the Constitution. You can't fund a war for more than 2 years. In other words, forcing legislators every 2 years to say, yes, we want to keep on having death and destruction and mayhem out there. I mean, all these kinds of things. If the Constitution so clearly, in so many ways, in Article 2, in Section 1 and in Section 8 of Article 2 of the Constitution, or Article 1, excuse me, of the Constitution, talks about how the legislative power, the war-making power, the war payment power lies exclusively with Congress, how does Bush, how's he going to get away with this? Oh, yeah. How's he gotten away with it in the last 5 years? Yeah. All right. So what are you hearing from your Republicans that you're talking? I know that you know a lot of Republicans as well as Democrats there on Capitol Hill. What's the gossip that you're hearing in the back channels, Victoria Jones?
Well, there is certainly some concern about this. I mean, there is some political feeling that, look, their worry is, if this, first of all, their worry is that this is going to be unpopular and that it's going to translate into unpopular polling for them and for the president, and by translation for them in the next few weeks, and they don't want that. But there's also concern that this is something that's just not doable, and that they are going to have to be going along with the president on this, because if they do split with him, that is going to just be looking extremely bad for them in terms of their legacies.
So you have Republicans who are concerned about, on the one hand, having a political food fight with George Bush, on the other hand, and appearing not to support the president, and how that may come back to haunt them. But on the other hand, if they support the president, they know that only, 15-19% of the American people are with them on that, and those are the ones who are on Prozac?
Right.
So it's a tough one. I mean, I'm hearing, like Gordon Smith, a Republican from Oregon, is saying, I don't think so. On the other hand, you got Mitt Romney, the Republican from Massachusetts. I mean, he's not an elected official right now. He's a presumptive presidential candidate, but or nominee or whatever, party. But he's coming out in favor of this. You got, John McCain out there running around going, yeah, we need more war. Is this going to tear the Republican Party apart?
No, I don't think it will. I really don't think it will, because I think this whole push by the president is going to be over quickly enough.
How then are the Democrats going to respond, and might the Democratic failure to have a united front tear the Democratic Party apart?
Well, I think the failure to have a united Democratic front is a problem for the Democrats. I do think that is a problem. But again, now that they're in overall power, I don't think it's as much of a problem for them as it was before.
Is it your sense that Bush is just going to start his so-called surge, his escalation, next Monday, just bang, right out of the, before anybody can do anything about it? Or do you think he's going to wait for Congress to say or do something?
Well, I don't know one way or the other, but my sense of it is that it's going to be more of a bang.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me at all. Victoria Jones, thank you very much for the report from Washington, D.C. and the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com today. Good talking with you, Victoria. Always good talking with you. 56 minutes past the hour. Coming up in the next hour, we're going to be talking with Larry Scott of VAWatchdog.org about what's going on with veterans these days. And we've got a little Everything You Know Is Wrong segment. We'll be taking your calls as well. Our telephone number, 866-440-THOM. And, of course, if you want to drop into our live chat room and say hi, go over to TomHartman.com, live chat, right up in the middle of the page, and just drop right in. It's free, it's easy, it's lots of fun. Some of the finest minds in the entire Internet hanging out there. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.TomHartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Definition of a bad policy.
Training your armed forces to break things and kill people, then denying them their VA benefits. That from the very top of VAWatchdog.org. Brilliant. Larry Scott, welcome to the program.
Tom, good to be with you again, and that really is a very bad policy, but unfortunately it's one we see a lot of today.
Yeah, I should point out to our listeners, Larry, you're the publisher, editor, chief cook and bottle washer, and all things extraordinary over at VAWatchdog.org, and you have up at the very top, you're keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to, VAWatchdog.org, one of the nation's leading veteran sites, and up at the top, you still have Jim Nicholson, the VA secretary,
yes.
The Republican political hack.
listed. But there's a new Democrat in charge of the House Veterans Affairs Committee and a new Democrat in charge of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. We touched on them briefly last week, but what do you see coming down the road now for veterans as a consequence of the Democratic takeover of Congress?
I see many good things coming down the road, and it's interesting that you ask that, because yesterday I spent a half hour on the phone with Congressman Bob Filner of California, who's chairman of the House Committee on Veterans Affairs. And we talked specifically about his agenda and what he's looking for. And his agenda basically is very simple. He's calling it keeping the promise. And he said that goes all the way back to World War II. And he is working together with his colleagues in the Senate. A couple of days ago, Senator Jim Webb of Virginia, the anti-Makaka, if you'll remember that.
Yep.
Jim Webb has introduced Senate Bill 22, which is a brand new version of the GI Bill. And what he's doing here is he wants to take the GI Bill back to exactly what it was at the end of World War II. His proposal is to pay 100% tuition, room, board, books, and give each GI $1,000 a month for additional expense money while they're in school. Basically to pay 100% for their education. It's incredible.
Wow.
Now, over on the House side, Representative Filner said he is going to work to introduce identical legislation on the House side so that when the House and the Senate bills come together, they'll be talking apples and apples. Yeah. They'll be going in with a powerhouse GI Bill.
Oh, that's such good news. Now, on the other side, there's some bad news out there. There's already a bill written repealing Attorneys for Veterans, this dirty deal?
The Attorneys for Veterans legislation was rather interesting. It got passed last year, and what this would allow attorneys to represent veterans in the VA claims process. Actually, they could up until this, but we had a Civil War era bill that limited their fees to $10. The veterans.
Not a lot of attorneys I know who will defend a case for $10.
No. The veteran service organizations, actually, a number of them are against this and have been against it because they provide for free a service called the Veterans Service Officers, who will file claims for a veteran. They don't charge for their services. But over the years, veterans law has become so complex, especially at the higher levels, and especially when you get to the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, that attorneys are really needed. This bill was passed. It was inserted into an omnibus bill, which was called Senate 3421, that had a lot of good veterans funding in it. But a deal was cut, and it appears that the rumors floating around Capitol Hill right now was that it was Senator Kent Conrad, Democrat of North Dakota, who was pressured by some special interest groups to what he did was, okay, we'll pass this big omnibus bill for all the funding, but since we don't want attorneys for veterans, we're going to write up repealer legislation right now and include it in the package that goes forward. So what happens is right now we're sitting in this little window where Attorneys for Veterans has passed, but the repealer legislation is already going around Capitol Hill. We're trying to rally the troops and say, kill that repealer legislation and let this go through. Veterans need attorneys in this process. But just a little bit.
Why would any Democrat, I mean, there's this shining moment here where Democrats can demonstrate that mm-hmm. they have been on the side of veterans all along and the Republicans have been keeping them down. I mean, you say Kent Conrad was pressured by special interests.
Right.
What does that mean? Does that mean somebody bought him off? Does that mean he cut
him? No.
You know, what's the deal here?
I don't think it's
why would he do this?
Okay, one of the
is he just assuming that you and I are not going to have this conversation and nobody in America is going to know that he's working behind the scenes to screw
well,
veterans?
That could be, and that's why his name is right at the top of VAWatchdog.org, so we can get this out into the open. One of the special interest groups that has worked very hard against this, believe it or not, is the Disabled American Veterans, the DAV. They feel,
which my grandfather was a member of.
Right, and of which I'm a member, too. The DAV feels that putting attorneys into the process would make this adversarial, which is really kind of a joke because the whole VA claims process is adversarial right now. We must remember the VA has an army of attorneys whose only job it is to say no and find ways to say no to veterans' claims.
Right.
The DAV also, what this really boils down to is a turf war, Tom. The DAV's service officers, the ones that work for the DAV now and help veterans file a claim at no charge.
They don't want competition from private attorneys.
They don't want competition. You've got to remember the service officers are prime recruiters for the DAV.
So this is very similar to the AARP. People think AARP is this wonderful organization for retired people. The reality is AARP is an insurance company.
You are right.
And that's why AARP supported the donut hole in the Medicare legislation, just because they knew that they could make a fortune selling the insurance to fill the donut hole. Right. And here you've got the DAV is behaving not like an organization representing disabled vets, but rather what? I mean, how do they make their money?
It's a turf war. They're protecting their own interests.
Do they charge enrollment fees? I mean, at least AARP makes a fortune on insurance. How does the DAV do it?
Yes, the DAV does it too. Let me give you
an example. They also sell insurance.
Young vet goes to the DAV rep and he says, I need some help with my claim. Help me file it. The rep puts all the paperwork through. The claim is approved. And then the DAV service officer can come back and say, hey, would you like to join the DAV now that you're approved? You meet all the qualifications of being a member. And of course, out of gratitude, most vets will say that. The DAV charges a one-time fee of $230 for a lifetime membership. Extrapolate that out by 10,000, 50,000, 100,000 people, okay? Mm-hmm. So the DAV fought this, really, it's a turf battle. What it would do is eat into their recruiting goals and eat into their membership. It's a shame, but we're pushing to get this repealer legislation pulled, and we hope it doesn't show up in any bills on Capitol Hill.
Amazing. Amazing. So, the curse of the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Oh, yeah, it really is. Well, let's get back to Bob Filner, if I can.
Yes, sir.
In my chat yesterday with the new chairman of the House Committee of Veterans Affairs, many, many issues. Full and mandatory funding for VA health care. He is pushing this. As we know right now, VA funding for the health care portion of the budget is discretionary. Every year the VA has to beg for money. It's a political football. Congress bats it around. They never get enough money. Congressman Filner wants to make it mandatory, and he will push that legislation this year. Another big...
What do you think the chances of that happening are, Larry?
Better than 50-50.
Really? That the veterans' budget will drop out of discretionary funding?
Yes, and I'll tell you why it's better than 50-50. That is, first of all, you have Democratic control of the House and Senate. You also have a number of Republicans who are in favor of this. The real key here is going to be how they set up this bill to determine the funding. Right now, the VA says, we need so much money, and then when they get the money, they give money to the hospitals and say, here's your money, take care of your veterans.
Right.
Well, we know there are more veterans than
yeah, it should be working the other way around.
And exactly
the amount of
and
money should be a function of the demand, not.
There will be all of these very complicated formulae that the VA would use where it would be exactly backwards, where the hospital will say, this is the number of veterans that are seeking care, these are our needs, it will go up the chain of command, these formulae will be applied, and then the money, without question, would come back to the hospitals and the clinics and the vet centers around the country. It's got to be done that way, and I think there's a better than 50-50 chance. Remember, though, we have to follow the new pay-as-you-go rules, okay? So funding is an issue. Where is the money going to come from? And they're going to have to be very careful when they write this legislation to make sure that the funding can be guaranteed. The other thing Filner's pushing for is more funding, more doctors, more counselors, more centers for mental health.
Right. Well, you've got this situation where Stephen Green, the guy who murdered that family, was actually diagnosed with homicidal ideations. In other words, he's thinking about doing this.
Right.
They gave him medication and sent him back into combat.
We just found this out yesterday. The Associated Press just released the story that Stephen Green he went in voluntarily for a counseling session. They counseled him, and he found out that he was angry about the loss of his buddies in combat, that he told them he wanted to go out and kill Iraqis, and they wrote homicidal ideations on his record, gave him medicine, sent him back into combat. If we have better funding and mental health funding, we can do away with some of these problems, Tom.
Yeah, well said. Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org, the website. Larry, you're doing great work. Keep it up.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Thanks for being with you. Good talking with you today. It's 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you, 1-866-440-8466. Talk radio for the rest of us.
We say we build democracy, but really build refineries and drill for our prosperity from oil in the ground. The earth just might be warming from the oil that we burn.
But I'm a simple man, and that's too difficult to learn. Forget about renewables like solar energy. 'Cause oil made my pappy rich, it's good enough for me.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, talking back to the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. You know, sometimes you know what's up. Sometimes you're not quite sure, and sometimes it is just so weird you can't even believe it's true.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync and think that you're out of your mind. Everything you know is wrong.
By the way, our Everything You Know is Wrong segment sponsored by LiberalStore.com. All things liberal in bumper stickers, buttons, T-shirts, and more. Check them out. Liberal Teddy Bear at LiberalStore.com. Well, here it is. Just when you thought it couldn't get weirder. This morning on Fox News, this is from the Center for American Progress, thinkprogress.org. This morning on Fox News, anchor Gretchen Carlson called Senator Ted Kennedy a hostile enemy of the United States. You think I'm making this up? I am not. I am not kidding. Here it is.
You talk about a hostile enemy obviously being Iraq, but hostile enemies right here on the home front. Yesterday, Senator Ted Kennedy proposing that any kind of a troop surge should mean that there should be congressional approval of that. Now, a lot of Democrats not coming to his side on this, but obviously this is not going to be an easy sell on Capitol Hill, even if it's not an easy sell to the American public.
Yeah, Ted Kennedy, a hostile enemy. Do you detect a theme coming out of the Reich? You know, could it?
So, all those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains?
Yeah, or this very strange talk show host out on the West Coast.
I am an American, and
So am I.
And where are you from, sir?
I'm from Eastern Germany, actually.
Eastern Germany? But yes. I would take it that you're probably Muslim.
No, I don't. I'm independent. I do not subscribe.
You know, but why don't you just right now say Allah is a whore, and that'll prove it to me.
I would not say that because I'm not... Who am I to say?
Say Allah is a whore. That'll prove to me you're not an Islamist.
I'm not insulted in Islamist. No, I do not believe in religion.
Okay, prove to me that you're not a Muslim. Say that you love eating pig.
Actually, I do like to eat pork. I'm a big fan of it.
Okay.
Now, can you imagine if a talk show host was like, prove to me that you're not a Jew. Prove to me that you're not a Christian. It is mind-boggling to me how hate and intolerance is being peddled by the Reich in this country and is being accepted. The scary part is not so much that it's being peddled. It's been peddled in the past in the United States and largely rejected and repudiated. You'll recall that moment when Mr. Welch said to Mr. McCarthy, "Have you no shame, sir?" But that this stuff just you know, flies it right on by. Let's, you know, just no problem. It is a problem in my mind. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Kyle in San Rafael, California, listening on the Quake. Hey, Kyle, what's up?
Tom, thanks for a great show. I think you've identified the crux of what we should all be watching for in Bush's speech. Butch, well, there you go. Butch.
Yeah.
Butch's speech.
Oh, it's this testosterone-driven, you know, hyper... Yeah. Go ahead.
It's whether he is going to follow the Constitution and let Congress have a say in whether we should commit more troops to a war that is not a war, is an invasion, an occupation, as you say, for oil. You've nailed it. And what I think scares me the most is that I just happen to have been reading William L. Shirer's book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich.
Oh,
and
man.
As angry as I am at the Bush administration, I am a little skeptical in comparing them to Nazis, after all. But I started this book, and it probably remains the best single, authoritative look at Nazi Germany. It's an 1,100-page book.
Yeah, wait till you get to the last chapter when he talks about the danger of the rise of fascism in America and the form that it'll take.
Absolutely.
Because he's predicting what we're seeing right now, and he wrote that book back in, 1952 or something?
Actually, it was 1959.
59.
But, you know, you're close enough. And the main thing here is that the rise to power of Bush is so parallels Hitler in these ways. After the Reichstag fire, you know, substitute 9/11, he suspended civil liberties.
The enabling acts. No, I've written the op-eds on it. It's a chapter in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? And actually, there's a chapter about it in Screwed as well, the parallels between the rise of Bush and the rise of Hitler. And it's really frightening, which is not to say that Bush is the mass murderer that Hitler was. We can't diminish, you know, the horror of Hitler by that comparison. But the reality is that Bush is using many of the same tools.
Yes,
that
the Enabling Act,
yeah,
which was passed in March of 1933, has its parallel in the
Patriot Act.
The very thing that that Kennedy, who in my mind is no traitor, but a hero, and really all Americans should flood his offices today with phone calls thanking him
You're absolutely right, Kyle. And thank you very much for the calling and for making the point. Yeah, absolutely. Give Ted Kennedy a call. 1-888-355-3588 is toll free to Congress. 27 minutes past the hour.
I vote for the Democratic Party. They want the UN to be strong. I attend all the Pete Seeger concerts. He sure gets me singing those songs. And I'll send all the money you ask for. But don't ask me to come on along. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal.
Yes. Welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, just a heads up for the month of January. This Friday night at 8:30, I'll be at the Nevada Theater in Nevada City, California. The Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival is one of the films playing. Is called Crude Impact. And I'm in it, in my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. And I'm only in it in a small way, but I'm in it. And so I'll be there, and I'll say a few words. And so that should be interesting. That'll be Friday night of this week. And on January 25th and 26th, I'll be in Washington, D.C. We'll be broadcasting live from the Mayflower Hotel. That's the week of the State of the Union Address. I'll be at the Families USA Conference. There'll be also a book signing and party at 7:30 on the night of the 25th. It's free and open to the public about my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, What We Can Do About It. And on March 1st and 2nd, I'll be back in Washington, D.C. the week later for a radio row sponsored by the American Conservative Union Foundation. And they tell me if I come to Washington, D.C. and set up at the radio row with all the right-wing talk show hosts, that Dick Cheney, Dan Coulter, David Keene, Congressman Mike Pence, Governor Mitt Romney, and Newt Gingrich will come talk to me. So we'll see how much courage these guys have. I'll show up. We'll see if they will. Anyhow, that's what's going on. Let's take before we get back to your calls, let's take a quick look at what's going on with the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know the men in the shadows of. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lights in the balance.
Security developments in Iraq as of 11:30 GMT on Wednesday. This compiled by Reuters. Dateline Kirkuk. A roadside bomb exploded near a car carrying the son of a police colonel, wounding him and two others in that northern city. In Tal Afar, a suicide bomber blew himself up in a busy market in that northern town, killing four people and wounding 11 others. In Baghdad, the U.S. military said 21 people were detained in a joint U.S. and Iraqi operation to clear a Sunni insurgent stronghold in the Haifa Street district of Baghdad. The operation involved 1,000 U.S. and Iraqi troops. In Qaim, four bodies with signs of torture and gunshot wounds were found. Near Tal Afar, a suicide car bomber targeting a police patrol killed a child and wounded three policemen. In Maha Wheel, the bodies of four people were found shot dead and bound. In Iskandaria, a body was found shot dead and bound in that town. In Tikrit, one U.S. soldier died from a gunshot wound. And in Mumadia, a car bomb exploded near a gas station south of Baghdad, killing one person and wounding three others. And George tonight is going to tell us how we need to amp this thing up.
1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Barbara in Seattle. Hey, Barbara, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I have been wondering, when John Negroponte was appointed as Condi's assistant, why in the world he would do that. And thinking along the lines that the Bush administration does everything for positioning, I read this article a couple of days ago that proffered the that said that what they thought was going to happen was that Dick Cheney was going to resign, or it was a possible scenario that he would resign. What with
and
all
Condi
the
Rice
the
becomes, becomes
the
appointed vice president
and all that, and can't have a guy that's got a bad ticker in the number two spot, especially when Nancy Pelosi's in the number three, and that once he would resign, Condi would be made vice president, and then Negroponte would be Secretary of State.
Yeah.
Which I think, what a scary scenario.
Yeah, indeed. And I suggested when it happened that moving John Negroponte into that position was being done for a reason, in part, frankly, because I think they also wanted to have a military person in charge of all of our intelligence, because they're preparing for war with Iran in March. But it's an interesting scenario. You know, the only time that a conservative has ever hung up on me In the 3.5 years, going on, it'll be 4 years in March that we've been doing this radio program, it was Dick Morris, a year and a half or so ago. He was on, and he had written a book about how Condi Rice was going to be the one who was going to run against Hillary Clinton. And, you know, he was just trashing Hillary Clinton. And I said, well, let's talk about policy stuff. Let's not get into personal stuff. And he just kept coming up with, well, you know, she has a psychopathic personality, quack, quack, quack. Or that, I'm not sure that that was the word he was using, but just, you know, characterizing her in ways that were highly personal. And finally I said, you know, Dick, if you want to talk about personal stuff, maybe we should talk about hookers. You know, of course, he was involved in that scandal.
Oh, yeah.
And at that point he said, okay, that's it. And he hung up. But, you know, and it was my way of trying to say, you know, let's stick to the issues. But the point is that Dick Morris may have called it right, you know, 2 years in advance, that it will be Condi Rice versus Hillary Clinton in 2008. I don't know. But, you know, I saw the same article that you're referring to, Barbara. It's not outside the realm of speculation. I suspect, though, that probably if Dick Cheney resigns, and I've been predicting for 3 years that he will within a year of the presidential elections, that they will replace him with John McCain or with Chuck Hagel, somebody that the Republican establishment, and in particular the Bush family, somebody loyal to the Bush family, wants to have pre-positioned to run for president in the Republican Party in 2008.
Yeah, you know, I thought the same thing. And then also with after Gerald Ford died, with all this, you know, all of us telling us that it was right that he pardoned Nixon and all
right.
that, you know.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, no, it was that was all setting up the pardons. So there was what the entire thing was about. Barbara, good point. Thank you very much for the call. Good to hear from you. Fred in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Fred.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you?
I'm always doing great. I want to invite you to look at things a different way.
Okay.
Most people look at things in terms of right and wrong and good and bad. And I look at things in terms of gracious and ungracious.
That's an interesting frame. Define gracious.
Well, grace is the awareness that choice might align benefit, might potentially align potential with opportunity to generate benefits.
This is sort of a variation on Dale Carnegie's old luck is when opportunity meets preparation?
No. It's understanding that choice serves a purpose.
Right.
And the major confusion in this world is that we're taught that good and evil are opposites, and they're not. The opposite of evil is gracious. The opposite of that which deprives of benefit is
right.
that which
and,
shares
and,
benefit.
Yeah, and the opposite of good is passivity.
The opposite of good is bad.
Yeah, well, no, I would say that's the use Robert McKee's language, the guy, the brilliant guru of screenwriting, he would say the opposite of good is bad, but the double opposite, the very worst opposite of good is being passive. That's the double.
Well, it's good that you bring up the double opposite, because the thing is, in a gracious universe, the lack of grace is ungracious.
Yeah. Yeah, no,
But evil becomes an ungracious assessment of ungracious choices.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting concept, Fred, and I thank you for calling and pointing it out. It's let me chew on that for a little bit. Jim in Tempe, Arizona, on the line. Hey, Jim.
Oh my gosh! Hey, Tom Hartman for president, man. You are my freaking hero.
Well, thank you. Not a chance I'll ever run for political office.
You are the man of details. You are just a wealth of information. I really
I'm having too much fun doing
your every word, dude. You are just like an unbelievable guy out there.
So what's up?
But anyway, I just kind of been waiting on the phone for a while, and I know you kind of addressed the issue of diplomacy versus the approach that it seems like the war generals have taken with the murder and so forth. But, you know, it's kind of ironically, I was reading this book, What the Buddha Taught, that you commented on that. And I really believe that Jesus must have been some type of Buddha back in the day. And just to take the comment further, you know, it seems to me that, you know, this world has been rooted in violence and murder forever. You know, there's never been any room for diplomacy. And most of us believe...
Actually, if I may just pause you there for second, Jim. I would suggest to you that it's not that the world has been rooted in violence and bloodshed forever. It's that our culture has. And most of us don't remember before the beginning of our culture, which was 5 or 6 or 7,000 years ago. But there was a time before our culture. And when you look at indigenous and aboriginal people, and or you go hang out with them or work with them, as I have on four continents, you discover that, by and large, they are not violent. They don't have cultures that are rooted in violence. They've figured out, through tens of thousands of years in trial and error, how to live together. And as Ben Franklin said in his opening speech to the Constitutional Convention, pointing to the 34 members of the Iroquois Confederacy who were there as observers, he said, if five nations of ignorant savages can form a union that has existed in peace for 1,000 years, then certainly 13 colonies of Englishmen can do the same. That I see the problem not in human nature, you know, to badly paraphrase Shakespeare about Caesar, not with us, but with our culture, frankly.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. I guess I'm referring to just recent American history, you know.
Yeah.
It seems like we started off this whole thing with really great intentions, but just somehow, you know, I saw this movie recently about why we fight, and I was thinking, you know, it's basically the Eisenhower administration.
Yeah.
And I just found it really ironic that, you know, he basically had seen this all coming. And, you know, with the military and industrial complex and, you know, the wealth of that business side of America, you know. But just to kind of, you know, finish up here, I know you got a lot of people on the line, you know. But the reason I tied the Buddha and the Jesus thing is it disappears that the really incredible phrasing was the truth will set us free.
Yeah.
And until we deal with the root of all these problems, which in this case, I think the war, you know, I've got a lot of friends that seem to think that the 9/11 thing was kind of a big cover-up and may have been part of this whole problem.
Yeah, but there's a bunch of truths that need to come out, Jim. You're spot on right, and we need to be bringing them out. And hopefully the Democrats will, and they will. Well, actually, not hopefully. They will if we hold their feet to the fire. 45 minutes past the hour.
Let's be the good guys again. We're going down the wrong road, my friend. Let's return our nation to its true destination. Let's be the good guys again.
And welcome back to the radio support group of By and For We the People of the United States of America. I rather prefer the Fire Sign Theater version of that. Anyway, welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Just real quickly, the news is coming out that Bush's so-called surge ain't a surge. And I think this is really interesting. When the American people are polled, this is a CBS poll that was released yesterday. When the CBS poll asked Americans if they were in favor of a short-term increase in troops in Baghdad, 45% said yes, 48% said no. But when they were asked if they were in favor of a long-term increase that could last up to a year and a half, only 18% of Americans said yes. In other words, the majority of Americans are opposed to an increase or an escalation. Only 18% support an escalation that lasts more than a few months. And yet now the word is coming out that what Bush is talking about is at least a year and a half surge, right? It ain't a surge. We're not talking about a surge here. We're talking about an escalation. We've already been in this war longer than we were in World War II. This is Lyndon Johnson all over again. This is Richard Nixon all over again. This is a tragedy, and it's going to lead to more death and destruction. And Therefore, in my opinion, we all have an obligation to speak out against it. Peter in North Hollywood, California. Hey, Peter.
Hey. I heard you say about the our culture being like 4,000 years old or something.
Yeah.
I have to assume that Denmark, the people over there are in the same culture. And my question is, why are they so much more socially responsible than we in the United States of America?
Because, in my opinion, they have gone in the evolution of culture one step beyond us. I mean, the fact of the matter is that our culture, just 200 years ago, we were holding slaves. We were highly, highly violent. We went through the whole Wild West thing. Women didn't even get the right to vote in the United States until 1920, as I recall, 17th Amendment. And or the 19th, I can't remember what it was, but in any case, the beginning of this century, this last century, and I'd say, you know, Europe is just a little ahead of us, you know, 20, 30 years ahead of us in terms of the evolution of Western culture.
So in other words, when we've been hearing lately the term old Europe and those people over there being labeled as socialists, that's totally wrong.
Well, I would say that the social democratic system that is being used by most of the Scandinavian countries, by all the Scandinavian countries, and most of the old Europe, the Western European countries, it's an improvement on what we've been. I mean, there's this steady, particularly since the creation of the United States of America, the first representative democratic, you know, republic. There has been a steady improvement, a steady increase, a steady positive evolution in our society. And we're moving back toward the goals, back toward the ideals, back toward the values that humans who have had tens of thousands of years to work it out by trial and error work out, which are ideals of egalitarianism and living together in peace.
They're doing it better than we are, though.
Yeah, clearly. In fact, there's a book out now called The European Dream that points out that the American Dream is no longer the American Dream for most of the world. Most of the world doesn't want to live like Americans do, terrified that one, you know, loss of your job means that you might be thrown out on the street and that you're one illness away from bankruptcy and wiping out your family. And that when you get old, that you're going to have to totally exhaust all of your savings and have nothing to give to your children because this giant death tax on the middle class of no healthcare system, no retirement system. And no, absolutely. I'd say the European dream is what is being held up now, and we should be paying very careful attention to it. Peter, I got to move along. I appreciate the call, though. Lynn in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Lynn.
Hi, Tom. I'm just very concerned and worried about the speech tonight. Mm-hmm. And I went and saw Aaron Latala last night speak live in Tacoma. It was very inspiring. What an amazing person.
He is.
And then I was just going to comment that you said something a little while ago that reminded me of the statement a few weeks back by Bill O'Reilly, something about do I care about the people of Iraq? Not at all. Just the contempt, the coldness in him. And he said, I think we should just basically ultimately bomb them into smithereens, and then we'd have a country to start with. You know,
there's a fundamental personal psychopathology there, and I think that there's also, reflects to a certain extent, a cultural psychopathology, and that's what we need to be calling out. We need to be talking once again, as Jack Kennedy used to, as the Republican Dwight Eisenhower used to, about the importance of peace in the world. Lynn, thank you for the call. Good point. Well made. Steve in Warwick, Massachusetts. Hey, Steve.
All right. Hi, Tom. Good job you're doing.
Thank you.
Yes, I want to make a comparison between President Johnson and Bush here and stuff. All right, he seems to have gotten us into the same fix that Johnson did during the Vietnam War, and it just goes to show you that we can't trust any president from Texas.
Yeah, good point. Good point. Thank you, Steve. Michael in Antioch, California. We just have a half a minute left here to wrap up the show. Michael, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, my father was a policeman, and I considered us middle class, and yet I'd like you to speak someday about the two different middle classes, policemen versus, union members that are on strike. Policemen, say Kent State, where those National Guards guys, those people wanted the same things as the people that they faced, and yet the middle class are fighting the middle class, and I don't understand.
Well, what's happening, Michael, is, you know, I mean, most cops are union members, and they are, you know, members of the middle class. The problem is that so much of the middle class is being turned into the working poor. This has been the agenda of the conservatives, starting with Reagan in 82. And, yeah, we'll talk about it more. In fact, we'll talk about it some more tomorrow. Coming up on tomorrow's program, the best of the rest of the news, plus David Hogberg, a conservative, telling us that liberals are going to make Medicare more expensive. That should be entertaining. And Greg Pallast is going to drop by on his new piece, The Big Easy to the Big Empty. That and more in your calls here on the Tom Hartman program. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.